The views and opinions of the host, guests, and callers of Radio Free ARFCOM do not necessarily reflect those of AR15.com, BBS Radio, or their advertisers. When any techniques, skills, or theories are presented, they reflect the practices and opinions of the individual presenting them, but not necessarily those of Radio Free ARFCOM, AR15.com, or BBS Radio. In all circumstances, Radio Free ARFCOM, AR15.com, and BBS Radio expressly disclaim any liability that may result in the use or misuse of any information featured in this program.
Transmission begins.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Here we go.
Let's go.
All this stuff you've heard about America not wanting to fight, wanting to stay out of the war, is a lot of horse dung. Americans traditionally love to fight. All real Americans love to stick in battle.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty, or give me death.
Radio Free ARFCOM starts now.
Welcome everybody out there in ARFCOM land. This is Radio Free ARFCOM coming to you from AR15.com, home of the Black Rifle. I'm your host, John Gold, and we've got another bang-up show lined up for you tonight. It has been a very, very lively weekend, has it not, with all the news stuff coming out, the terrorist attacks in Russia, the FBI raids here in the United States. It has been very, very interesting, to say the least. And if you haven't been online, if you haven't been on AR15.com checking out some of the threads, you better get on, because it is on fire right now. The message boards are on fire. Today's show, we'll start off with Joe DeBurgolis, our resident NRA expert and board member. We've got David Bellavia. He's going to come on later. He's a former veteran, very decorated veteran, and he's got a lot of insight into some of the stuff our military is going through now and some of the growing pains it's going to be going through in the future. We've got a special Get to Know today with The Kill, going to be on Get to Know. Also, Trey Tuggle is going to be on. He's a former Navy SEAL, and he's the new director of the NRA Tactical Rifle Group. So for those of you that don't know about that, the NRA is actually taking some big strides to go towards more tactical shooting stuff, and he's going to be in charge of that whole deal for him. Also, a very special unannounced guest that I did not put in the show announcement, Nick Ranstadt, will be on at the end of the show tonight. He just got back from the Bataan Memorial March in New Mexico, and he's going to talk with us about that as well as about Ranstadt's militia, as you all know about that. So without further ado, let's go straight to Joe DeBurgolis. Joe, how are you today?
Great, John. Great. It has been a very busy weekend.
It's always good to hear your voice. Now, I talked to you the other day, and you told me you had an NRA dinner this weekend. Is that right?
We did. I'm on the committee of the Greater Niagara Friends of NRA up here in the Buffalo, New York area. And we had a great turnout. We had a record turnout of close to 500 people. And we're kind of proud of the whole thing, because when we started this a few years back, we started with a scant 25. And through the years, through a lot of determined effort through the committee, and I have to give out the proper recognition to the chairman, David McDonald, and his family. They do a great job. We grew it to 500. And these are kind of a fraternal type of get-together of people who support the NRA, and all the money that's raised goes to the NRA Foundation. 50% comes back to the area where the money was raised, and 50 of it goes into the foundation to help out other supported shooting disciplines or safety messages or wherever the foundation believes the best best serves. So it was a great, great weekend, and we raised a lot of money, and we've been told that there's been record turnouts throughout the country for our Friends of NRA events, so it's all good.
You told me that when you started out, you didn't get that many people to these dinners, and now it's just you guys are bursting at the seams up there.
We are. We had 25 initially. We got some people together, and through the years, through a lot of good effort from the committee, it has grown to close to 500 people, and that's just ours. We actually had the largest Friends of NRA dinner here in New York State. Great folks down in the Hudson Valley get the most people out there and have raised the most money I believe they're close to $2 million total raised from the beginning when they started. So all
wow.
this is going towards the good. I believe if we look at the total amount raised through all the friends of NRA system, we're up and over $100 million.
Wow, that is outstanding. That is outstanding. And we know that money's all going to a good cause for sure.
It surely is. Like I mentioned, half of it comes back to the area where it's raised. The other half goes to support the foundation and all the great things they do.
Before we go into the big issue I wanted to talk with you today, I want to remind all our listeners, if you have any questions for Joe, they're NRA or legally related, law related with gun laws, feel free to call in right now and we will get you on the air as soon as we can. There was a big story on the NRAILA.org website that I just had to talk about. We thought we had this thing licked with Heller versus D.C., but apparently there is now a district judge that is made a ruling that seems to go against the gains we made in Heller versus D.C. I'm not sure. I read the article, and I'm not really good with legal matters. I'm just a regular Joe Schmo, so maybe you can help me out here. What is going on with this Judge Ricardo Urbina?
Well, I'll do my best, because I'm not a legal eagle by any stretch of the imagination. But as we all know, Heller, on appeal, was turned in our favor. Mayor Fenty of Washington, D.C., and the council there decided to challenge a variety or put obstacles in the way of what the Supreme Court has ruled in that federal enclave. So by doing so, Mr. Heller and his attorney, Stephen Holbrook, well, people will remember, did a fantastic job in the arguing of McDonald versus Chicago. Came forth, and they were basically arguing that this is the mayor of D.C. and his council, that they can't put restrictions, as they call reasonable restrictions, on the type of firearms that people can have in their homes. Specifically, they're looking at so-called assault weapons and high-capacity magazines.
Joe, real quick, let me interject so everybody knows. They're ruling high-capacity magazines as anything over 10 rounds. Is that correct?
Exactly. They took the national standard, and they said anything over 10 rounds is high-capacity.
Okay.
So from there, what transpired is they put these obstacles in play. Judge Urbina came forward, and with his decision that we're talking about now, stated that, in fact, the enclave, the federal enclave, city of Washington, D.C., can, in fact, prohibit those type of firearms and those high-capacity magazines. So we're going to look at, and a lot of people on the message boards are blowing up and are waiting to see what transpired. But let's remember that when Heller first was brought forth, we lost. Then upon repeal to an appellate division, we went through the process, and we were victorious. I have every confidence that we're going to appeal this decision, and we're going to go forward. I think we're going to be a little bit, by the time we appeal, we'll have what's going to happen. We'll have a verdict out in Illinois from the Supreme Court, and that will embolden our argument even that much stronger. But this is what's going to happen nationwide, John. You're going to see a lot of challenges once we're finally through the incorporation of the Second Amendment, and they put that to the test. You're going to see all these more restrictive states, New York included, you're going to see these challenges one by one by one.
Okay. Yeah, I was reading through this article, and it's like, I don't know where this guy gets this. It's like mind-boggling. It's like the Supreme Court already has ruled this, and then you want to go back and take the dissenting judge's argument and use that as your way to uphold. It's just amazing. I guess we just have to go through the legal hurdles, but it's just the money we have to spend on this that could be spent on something else. I guess that's what's bothering me the most.
Oh, most certainly. But this is obviously another obstacle, and the reason why we have to be ever vigilant and keep going forward. We've got the best legal minds working on this. Stephen Holbrook is a fantastic Second Amendment and constitutional lawyer. He's looking into this. There's going to be more said on this case. And I think it's going to be on our side. It's going to be, when it's all said and done, it's going to fall to our side. But we have to go through these legal steps.
Got to jump through the hoops for him. Yeah, I'm with you. I think that eventually we'll appeal this and it'll get overturned, especially when we get Chicago on our side. And I'm with you. I have every confidence that Chicago will fall in our favor. I don't see how it can't. I don't see how it can't.
I'm with you, John. I believe that it's going to go in our favor. And but there's another step. I mean, and this is as much as we advocate for our side. They have the Brady campaign and a variety of other anti-gun groups trying to do the same thing to thwart our freedoms. The one main thing we have going for us is they can't refute what we have. The Bill of Rights, it's on our side.
Right, right. We always have that. The Second Amendment is very, very strong in our favor. Now, I want to talk a little bit about you, Joe. We talk all the time about issues, but I talked to you earlier this week, and I was asking you about your background in law enforcement. I had no idea. I knew you were in law enforcement, but I had no idea you had the extensive background that you did. Can you just tell our listeners a little bit about how you came up through the ranks in law enforcement, all the different things you've done?
John, I would absolutely love to, but I have to beg off of that question. I apologize.
Oh, do you?
I do. I have to basically safeguard what I do for a living.
Okay.
Just myself as an art commer and as an advocate for the Second Amendment.
Okay, that's fair enough. Suffice it to say, everybody, Joe has an extensive background. He is well-versed in a lot of different areas. He's not just one regular, been involved in one part of it, and he's definitely qualified for the position that he holds now. There's no question about that. Do you have any matches coming up soon? You told me you were going to get ready to do some three-gun stuff.
We do. We're very excited here nationally, as a member of the three-gun committee, the multiple gun committee, by appointment of President Ron Schmidt, we're going to go down to the Blue Ridge Championship down in Kentucky about the last week of April. Myself, Trey Tuttle will be down there, and we're going to go basically on a fact-finding tour, listening tour, if you will, find out what the shooters would like the NRA to do on behalf of their sport. I'm a multi-gun shooter myself. I love three-gun. I love the tactical and practical aspects of it, event shooting as well. It's one of these things where my personal belief is we as the NRA should be there to support it. We should be there to publicize it. But what we don't want to do is bring more and more confusing rules to an otherwise well-rounded sport. We want to be there to support it. We want to make sure there's an entry level for people to get involved if they're so inclined. But the people who are basically have grown this from a cottage type of match to something that's a nationwide appeal, we want those people to be the ones that basically run the show.
Sure, that makes sense as well. It makes sense. One of our guests coming on later in the show that you know, Trey Tuggle, he just got back from a three-gun match. It was his first one I think he ever went to, and he's so excited to talk about it. And I'm excited to talk to him as to be able to talk to someone who is.
Sorry about that. A little technical problem we seem to have every now and again, Joe. I was just in the middle of telling everyone how thankful I am and how responsible you are for getting most of our guests on. It's not me that actually gets most of them on. I get a few. I book a few on my own, but a lot of the guests we get come from you, and I can't thank you enough for that.
Well, John, I believe in what you're doing. I believe in what ARFCOM is all about, and it's a pleasure to bring these people forward. They really want to get the message out, and they want to see Radio Free ARFCOM really go to the highest level it can.
And we're going to do our best to really get this show, keep it going, improve the quality each time, and try to keep these quality guests coming on. We get a lot of requests, Joe, and I'll just bring this up real quick before I let you go. We get a lot of requests to get Ted Nugent on, and I've tried to contact his people. I was hoping maybe if you get a chance at the annual meetings this year, if you get a chance to bump into him, if you can somehow try to work your magic with him.
Well, I will definitely try my best. You know, Uncle Ted's one of the most prolific speakers when it comes to Second Amendment. He not only wears it on his sleeve, he wears it as a shield for going into battle. I'm also one of his regional directors for the United Sportsmen of America. So I will do I was going to try to surprise you, but I have actually called, talked to some people there. We're going to do our very best to get him in line for the show. He's extremely busy, as you might suspect. maybe if we can do a few things, and we'll make it happen.
Outstanding. Hey, Joe, thanks for everything you do. Hopefully this hella thing will work out in our favor. I'm sure it will, and I appreciate your help with the show. I really do. Thanks a lot.
Have a good show, John. Bye-bye now.
Okay. We'll talk to you next week. That was Joe DeBurgelis, our NRA board member. He is the first AR15.com endorsed candidate for the NRA board. We have several more now. I think you've got a few days left to vote if you are an NRA, if you're a voting member of the NRA. Get your votes in. Make sure you vote for the NRA endorsed candidates. They all are proponents of the Black Rifle, the AR-15 platform, and they work really hard to make sure that things, arguments and that we have, and the problem, the, not the problems, but the concerns that we have, get taken care of and addressed. Our next guest coming up is David Della Via. He's a former Army Infantry Staff Sergeant. He served in the 1st ID, 1st Infantry Division, for over 6 years. He's been nominated for the Distinguished Service Cross and the Medal of Honor for his actions in the Battle of Fallujah that everyone is well aware of. He actually received the Silver Star and the Bronze Star for valor, and the Conspicuous Service Cross, which is New York State's highest award for combat valor. He's just an amazing guy. He's an author and a blogger. He stays up to date on all the most important military news and news around the world. And it's really great to have you on, David. How are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Doing great. Having a little technical problems, but we'll get through it like we always do. I really appreciate you taking some time out. I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Absolutely. Everything's great.
I appreciate you taking some time out to be with us here on the show. I want to start out and talk a little bit about your time in the military. You were in the Gulf War, this most recent one. You wrote your book, The Hot Zone, and all that. Can you talk a little bit about, let me thank you for your service while I'm at it. Thanks a lot. We appreciate everybody who serves, goes and really puts their life on the line for our freedom. We really appreciate that.
Well, hey, I appreciate you saying that. It really does mean a lot.
Why don't you talk a little bit about what motivated you to go in the military, to actually serve in the infantry, actually, which is, you know, that's not the rear echelon. That's right up on the front lines, and it takes a lot. It takes a certain individual to be able to do that.
Well, you know, one of the things that I had a pretty crazy event. I'm from Western New York, and I had some guys, two guys on drugs, broke into my we had a home invasion. I was in college. My parents were at home. And these guys broke into our home and, you know, roughed up, you know, just totally emasculated me and saw a lot of fear in my parents' eyes and the house was destroyed, and these guys did it right in front of us. And I realized that at the age that I was at, I really wasn't a man, and it was time to really kind of man up. And, there was really no war going on. The Army was, I say it was like summer camp with bad haircuts. You know, we were just kind of hanging out and shooting rifles at a range. There was no war going on. These kids that are joining today are joining at a time of war. And that, to me, is a far greater sacrifice than anything I did, in the late 90s, because these kids know where they're going when they sign the dotted line, and they're doing it in record numbers, and it shows exactly what type of quality of young Americans I think are going off to war.
It does. We talk a lot about, the media especially talks a lot about how this next generation and all the problems they have, but there are quite a large number of people coming up in this younger generation that are just top-notch individuals, and they just, like you said, they know when they sign and they take that oath, they know that there's a chance they're going to be deployed. And most of them, it's almost a guarantee with some of the MOSs they choose that they're going to be deployed. And they still do it. They do it in huge numbers, and it's just amazing.
It is. And not only that, you know, the group that, you know, I was active duty, but the guard and the reserve component, to me, are the greatest patriots of all of them. Because these are guys that, you know, they work 9 to 5. They don't have, you know, everyone talks about, well, the training's different. It really isn't about the training. What it is, it's about the environment that you surround yourself in your active duty. Everyone in your, when you wake up and have an omelet to when you go to bed, Everyone is experiencing what you're experiencing. Everyone went on the road march. Everyone knows how bad and how cold the rain was. When you're in the reserves, you go back to working at the factory, you go back to the office. No one knows what you're going through. No one knows what, you know, how was your summer? Well, I went to Afghanistan for a year, and I can't tell anyone at the water cooler about it because Sharon from accounting will have a heart attack and fall into the fetal position. So I got to keep all that within. Those reserve guys and those National Guard guys, those to me are really kind of the cream of the crop because they've got a whole lot to give up. Their quality of life, their careers, they put everything on hold, their families. Those guys are some studs. So if you're out there and you've got a reservist in your family, make sure you give them an extra special hug because they really are special.
Yeah, they are a special group of people. Like you said, I never thought of it in that context, but that's true. They go back to civilian life, and they really have no one to relate to once we go back. They're kind of on their own out there. It's a very interesting perspective that you bring. I want to remind our listeners, if you have any questions or comments for David, just feel free to call in, and we will get you on the air as soon as we can. I want to talk about your book, Into the Hot Zone. I'm guessing I have not had a chance to read it yet, but it's mostly about the battle for Fallujah. Is that correct?
Actually, the book is called House to House. The In the Hot Zone is referring. That was the cover story of Time Magazine in 2004.
Okay.
But
House to House
book is actually called House to House, and it pretty much is there's a lot of books out there. You know, we're watching Pacific on HBO, and everyone's like, you know, is this kind of a breakdown of what you know the Fallujah fight was? Not really. This is just I sat down and everything I had to look at. Going into war and combat always seemed to have like this almost Victorian era filter on it. Even Oliver Stone's work, it was always kind of filtered through this like malaise of this fake. I wanted people to know everything that we go through, the diarrhea, the smell of a rotting corpse, the way every single time a tracer round ricochets off a wall. The way metal feels when it cuts into your teeth, all these things that we experienced in a house fight, no one's unscathed inside of a building in a firefight. Everyone gets hit, whether it's shrapnel or concrete plaster. Everyone leaves bloodied and hurt when they're in a house fight. And their death, the lack of – it's amazing when you're in a concrete structure and you're exchanging fire with someone it's just the OK Corral. You could go to the range and shoot your AR 5,000 times a day. At the end of the day, if a guy shows up on the other side of a wall, it's selector switch and fire. And whoever can get as many rounds in the box, dropping the target, is the victor. It's like paintball, you know, where you die if you lose. And I don't think Americans understand that. It's a huge adrenaline rush, but at the same time, it's fear. And it's glory at the same time, all woven into one. And then when you kind of step back away from combat, you realize how absolutely inhumane and horrible it can be. But at the same time, that sacrifice and that valor is really kind of based out of love. So the one thing that you find in a battlefield is really love. And it was odd to me, and I thought it would be odd to most Americans if they kind of, you know, got the absolute truth. And the book is disturbing, don't get me wrong. I mean, this is an NC-17 book. The language is, you know, horrible, but the violence is, you know, some of the worst stuff I think anyone could imagine. But that's what our men and women are going through, so, you know.
Yeah, the window, just from the reviews I read about it, the window that you opened to the rest of the world to how it really was fighting there in Iraq, door to door, house to house, room to room, basically. That's just, I just can't even fathom it. I just can't. It's hard for someone who hasn't even been there to wrap their mind around, but I'm really looking forward to reading this book. You talked a little bit about everybody gets bloodied, and people don't really see that with the movies or Hollywood or the way the media portrays war. Has there been anything that you've seen that's actually you thought, you know what, that kind of takes me back? Like, did you see The Hurt Locker? Did any of that take you back? And you were like, wow,
it felt different. I mean, I'm sure, you know, a Vietnam vet is going to, everyone's war is different and everyone has different experiences and, you know, you know, Way City was a whole lot different than Yadrang, and, you know, all throughout our different battles that we've experienced. For the urban fight, I've seen a lot of, like, to me, there's a movie, believe it or not, there's a Korean movie called Taegukgi that was done in 2005. And that is some of the most realistic urban fighting. The plot is horrible, and it's in Korean, but it takes place in the Korean War. But that's some of the most realistic effects of what the noises and sounds are like in an urban environment. You know, it's one of those things, like, you know, we teach our kids to throw grenades inside of a building. We teach them how to enter and clear a house. But you don't think, you know, a concrete room, you start whipping grenades into an interior wall, that's going to tic-tac-toe around in a concrete structure. You might teach a kid how to get behind a car, you know, for cover. But in a training environment, they're not shooting at you. You know, if you hang out behind a trunk, you're going to get popped. You got to hang out by the engine. You know what I mean? Like, all these different things that you learn in real time, all these things that you learn, you know, from someone getting shot, someone getting hurt, someone losing their life, it's almost like it's a daily lessons learned. Every single day you're out there. You know, I hear about these guys that only do 7-month tours in the combat zone. I just think that's a real disservice to the veteran. I think if you're going to go to war, you know, yeah, I don't want to be away from my family, but I'd much rather do 12 months than I would 7, because I think I'm a better warrior for having that extra time to really kind of know what I'm up against. And you learn so much. So, like, Hollywood's only going to give you, like, a little taste of it. But there's, you know, there's a lot of different movies that'll show you different things. Just for the urban fight, I haven't seen one. I mean, Black Hawk Down is kind of a joke. You know what I mean? Just because of the – it's just absurd. I mean, it's so much – the realism is kind of is gone. But again, I wasn't in Somalia, so I don't know what it was like. But for me, that was kind of a joke.
Right. Right, I understand. And for everyone, I wanted to just get your website out there. It's davidbellavia.com. Just that simple, davidbellavia.com. He's got a great blog. You've actually got some interesting bloggers that blog with you. You want to tell me a little bit about those guys?
Yeah, you know, I've just been collecting, you know, a lot of my friends and, you know, fathers of guys who served over in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, got some guys who've done some special operations out there. And just pretty much just kind of built a little circle of guys that I really trust and I really like, and we all think relatively the same way. I mean, there's some differences of opinion here or there. But, I mean, the whole idea of this thing was that, you know, if you want to get news, go to another site. You know, there's a lot of places out there that will inform you. But what I'm just looking to do is just kind of put the infantryman's spin on everything that's happening in this world. And we're not just talking about military things. I mean, we kind of go, you know, like the modern soldier, we're kind of involved in everything. So, you know, we get upset about politics like everyone else, but these guys are good guys, and they've all been there, done that. And, you know, they're getting a pretty good following. Some of these guys get more hits than I do. And I think that they're slowly taking over the blog in a coup d'etat. So I'm going to have to,
hey, that's fine, though,
that.
Right?
They can't control it.
So do you get together with some of the guys you served with in Fallujah? Do you guys still get together sometimes?
You know, regrettably, we lost a lot of guys out there, and that number is getting smaller and smaller, you know, every day. You know, we just lost a really good friend of ours not more than, you know, 3 weeks ago. Got hit with a rocket in Afghanistan. You know, these kids, to make it out of Fallujah and their second tour, and you lost, you know, you lose more guys in the third and fourth and fifth tour, and now Afghanistan gets kicked off, and, you know, there's, I don't know of any, I mean, I know that my one, everyone in first squad of my platoon, everyone had a bullet wound, everyone got shot in that squad, and, you know, when you start to kind of draw it over, it's just the, you know, law of averages, you're going to lose guys, you're going to get guys that are going to be dinged up. So regrettably, I just don't have the ability. These guys are either out of the army or they're convalescing or they're in heaven, you know, and it's hard to kind of, and then the other thing is that, you know, a lot of people don't want to talk about this stuff, not because they don't want to relive it, but because they don't want to freak their families out. And that was the one thing I found with talking about something like Fallujah, is that I could handle it and the other veterans could handle it, but everyone else in my world was all freaked out because no one knew these stories before.
Right.
And so they're all like, and I was coaching my son's soccer team, and I had people like come up to me and they're like, "Whoa, I had no idea, you know, what you've done. I'm a little weird about you, you know, with my kid teaching soccer." And I'm like, "Are you kidding me?
That's the type of person I'd want teaching my kid soccer." So
"What are you talking about?" So I shot him. No, I didn't. No, but you know what I mean. So I was like, you know, I'm not going to snap. I'm totally cool. I mean, that's the professionalism of a professional soldier. That's what we do. But it was just kind of like, you know, all my friends are going through that. I hear that constantly over and over and over again. You know, and it's the family, it's the people around you that you have to protect from that other life. So when we get together, the guys that are still around and we have a few beers, we have to make sure that the doors are closed and that, you know, no one's around because we don't want to freak anyone out.
Yeah, I understand that totally. It's just such an interesting perspective that you have, and then the way you speak about it, it's really refreshing to hear. You spoke a little bit about Afghanistan. I know you still have contacts in the service. I know you still follow the situation very closely there. Can you give us kind of an update on what's going on? They had the recent offensive that kicked off. What's the situation like over there right now?
Well, I mean, the majority of the action right now is happening out in the southern southwest province, Helmand, which, you know, people probably know, you know, by Marja was the last offensive that kicked off. It was supposed to be like Fallujah. The problem with Marja happens to be like the epicenter of where all the opium trade is coming in and out of. It's like the, you know, the little rest stop where if Marja is controlled by NATO forces, it's very difficult for these guys to move the opium. It's very difficult for any of the supplies to get into the areas where the poppy fields are.
Okay.
And so that was a huge, you know, that was kind of the heart of Helmand. And that was supposed to be a Fallujah type of assault, and it wasn't. The Marines that led that invasion, there was obviously British American Army there too, but the Marines were very methodical about the way they massaged that city. The population was still there. As in Fallujah, the population was gone, so they were really kind of hamstrung as far as what they could do. But what we started to see with Marja, I think it's the first offensive that you've seen in this, I would say, Iraq and Afghanistan counterinsurgency thing, is this is the first type of battle that we want the enemy to leave the city. It's advantageous for our forces to not have to fight in an urban environment. So what you try to do is you tell the people, look, trust us, we're not going to hurt you, but check it out. You know, we're going to line up a bunch of people out here, and we're going to come into the city. You know, the enemy, if you want to stick around, civilian population, you're probably going to get hurt. Get these guys out of here. And the enemy, we give them enough opportunity to get out of the city, hold the city, occupy it, and clamp it down so they can't get back in. And basically, yeah, you're letting the bad guys fight another day, but you're not letting, you know, you're kicking them out of the city. The next offensive, which I think is going to be far more bloody, and we're starting to see it kicked off about 2 weeks ago, is Kandahar. And, you know, that is that's going to be a rough area. Not only is it a larger city, it's up north from Helmand, but it's just, you know, it's basically the Baghdad of Afghanistan, just a highly dense population, a lot of bad IEDs, but more importantly, just a larger population of enemy forces to fight, and they can melt away into the small pockets of the civilian neighborhood. So that one is going to carry us probably into the fall as far as that offensive goes, and we're seeing a totally different timetable, whereas, you know, Fallujah and Ramadi, these are what we call kinetic fights. A kinetic fight, you really want to kind of end it in 21, 30 days. These counterinsurgency fights are all about trusting the people, getting the people on your side, using the least amount of force that you possibly can, but holding the areas that you knock over. Where Fallujah and Ramadi, we cleared the city and got the hell out. And then the bad guys can kind of, you know, melt back in. And then you got to do an Old Testament, kill everything that's in the city because you ignored it. With Petraeus and with General McChrystal now leading the charge, you're seeing a very slow massage of these different areas. And there's not going to be tanks. There's not going to be the heavy armor, more likely because of the terrain in Afghanistan, but you're not going to see the heavy footprint that you had in Iraq. This is going to be a lot a lot focused totally on what the population thinks of NATO forces. And so instead of 30 days, it'll take 4 or 5 months. And that's just the way we have to prepare for it. And the American population also has to prepare for loss, and there's going to be a lot of loss. And it's not going to be the type of loss that we might shoot the bad guy in a firefight. It might seem one-sided, but at the end of the day, we're not really hearing a lot about the bad guys that we're killing. So
yeah, it's interesting that you say that. We don't hear a lot about that. We hear a lot about our casualties, but the casualty numbers for the enemy seem almost like you can't even find them.
Right. I don't necessarily – I mean, in the old days, I used to think that, you know, there's a lot of problems with the way casualty numbers are counted. I always thought that we should announce every bad guy that we killed and the country that they came from just to let the American people know that this is still a war. But I guess when you do that, you're also kind of playing into the PR game that the enemy uses. The enemy has an amazing psychological operations that they use on our – they play our own media against us. They have video footage. They know how to edit. A firefight will be on the Internet in 2 hours after the last round was fired, and they know how to use it. And so if we started coming out there and saying, hey, we killed 25 bad guys – All we needed is to be off by five dead bad guys, and all of a sudden the military is lying. And once you can create that little gap of the army isn't telling you the truth, now we don't have credibility. And so we kind of get away from that game.
So the internet has changed the way that those things get taken care of, huh?
Hey, dude, and also we catch the enemy just exaggerating all the time. I mean, you know, Baghdad Bob in early 2003 was just a classic example. If we ever got caught in those types of embarrassing PR, circumstances, those are things that not only affect the mission, they affect the population. Not only the population that we're occupying and that we're trying to protect, but back home, too. We don't want another Vietnam where no one could trust anything that the military was putting out. You know, wait a minute, you killed the population of Vietnam like 4 times over. Now, what's going on here? As soon as you lose that trust, the people will start to turn on your mission. So I understand why the military is doing what they're doing. It's very, very hard to explain that to the kids on the ground, though, because they want their moms and dads to know that they're winning. And
Right. Sometimes
that gets kind of clouded.
Yeah, that's interesting. I spoke to you last week a little bit, and you were telling me something interesting about the Marine Corps, that actually the Commandant of the Marine Corps is actually behind this. They're trying to move from the 5.56 to the 6.8 round?
Well, yeah, it's actually General Mattis, who I think many will argue will be the next Commandant of the Marine Corps. General Mattis will end up being the patent of this global war on terror. I consider it one of my, you know, if I could have served under General Mattis, it would have really made my career. I mean, this is literally a chesty puller of modern times. I mean, a brilliant, brilliant strategist, just a cut from Spartan rock as far as American warriors goes. He's a stud. Now, he wants a 6.8 millimeter, and the argument is basically, you know, we've always heard that the 5.56 doesn't have the stopping power. That the 7.62x3.9, which is what we fight with a Kalashnikov in Afghanistan and in Iraq. But the problem is that the standoff distance in the fight in Afghanistan, because of the mountain, but also because of the elevation, is a lot farther apart than it is in Iraq. We trained in Iraq for a 100-meter firefight, and most times in Fallujah it was a 5-meter firefight. You don't really want your kids, you know, shooting in small target areas like faces, and you want center mass shots. That's the easiest thing to hit, and that's where you want to kind of, direct the fire. But once you've trained people over and over and over again for what we call CQB, close quarter battle, you tend to lose the fundamentals of marksmanship. And again, you know, the 300-meter shot was non-existent in Iraq unless you had a Leopold and a Barrett or you know, a sniper weapon of some sort. And now what we're seeing in Afghanistan is, man, those fights are way long distance, and some of them are over 300, 400, 500 meters. And so we're putting these ACOG 3X sights on these 5.56 rounds. And, you know, you got a nice flat trajectory on a 5.56 at 250 to 300. And then over that, you start to get a pretty good bend. And you lose speed. And the 6.8 is going to give you a lot, you know, more of a reach out and touch you, you know, a bigger ballistic, a bigger bullet, and it's going to go farther. And it's something that, you know, you're going to want. You know, a tracer burnout of a 7.62 NATO round is 900 meters. And tracer burnout of 5.56, you know, we're not even in the same ballpark. However, the reality is that no one is going to be able to get that ballistic across the core in time to win this war in Afghanistan. It's just logistically impossible. And I mean, come on, how many rifles do we have? I mean, you can, you know, I believe that the M16, the M4, is the finest rifle that's ever been made. You know, for everything negative that they talk about an M4, I can give you an FAA. I can give you any rifle in the world. And the best, when someone's like, well, how good is the M4? Every single time someone finds an M4 on the ground, it's there for 2.5 seconds. It is gone.
You're telling me that. The enemy, if they get a chance to get one, they take it. And they cobble those things together and try to keep them together and working as long as possible. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, if there's a website that sells parts of the AR, you're going to, you know, sometimes you got to check on where those things are going because they might be headed to Jordan and Iraq. They'll piece those things together left and right. But again, I've never, ever seen when you come up to a fallen soldier and you see the aftermath of an ambush, there's a lot of gear that's there. That, you know, that M9 Beretta, that 9mm is always there. No one's taking that anywhere. But damn it, if that rifle isn't gone. And it's not the gear. It's not the toys on the rifle. And everyone's like, oh, it's got all these great toys. Well, if you don't have the night vision, you can't use any of those great toys. And the AK-47 might be reliable, but it really isn't the best. A lot of these things aren't just they're put together just poorly. They're you know, pushed out and just not very well constructed. Where that weapon system is, if you love it, it's going to love you back five times. And I've never had any issue. You know, if you have a clean bolt assembly. And magazines. Matter of fact, magazines are 98% of all your malfunctions on an M4, M16 anyway.
Are they really?
Oh, absolutely. If you're everyone that spends all their time cleaning their rifle, fantastic, absolutely. Clean that bore out. Make sure that everything is spotless. But really, you got to pop those magazine springs, and you got to clean the rounds, and you got to oil those things up because. A bad magazine makes the cleanest weapon in the world worthless, you know, and
that's
it really comes down to that mag too. But I'm telling you that the 6.8 is fantastic. I would have killed for that thing in a house fight, you know, because I would have, you know, you're not getting up after two rounds center mass there. But, you know, we can't even get socks to some of our guys. God forbid if we try to get them all new weapons. I see that just as a logistic nightmare. So if anything, this is like 2040 stuff. This is 2020 stuff. This is not, you know, 2012, 2013.
And hopefully we'll be out of Afghanistan and finished with that by that time. We'll be looking at whole new conflicts probably by the time, even if they do decide to adopt the 6.8. The question I have about the Marines adopting it, and then does that mean that the Army adopts it too and everybody else adopts it, or would it just be the Marines with it and everybody else has a different platform? There's just some inconsistencies there that I don't think I understand.
Yeah, I mean, there's always going to be some uniformed, you know, a lot of people were confused when we got rid of the M60 machine gun, and everyone seemed to be like, well, the M60 worked fine. What was the problem with the M60? Well, we went, the military went over to the 240 series, not because of the you know, reliability of the M60, but just because the coax machine guns on all these armored vehicles were all 240 series. So it's just easier to manufacture the parts. It's easier to buy them in bulk. You know, a 240 Bravo, a 240 Gulf. The Marine Corps uses the Gulf model. We use the Bravo model. And then you've got all these different, you know, you just basically take out the buttstock and throw a plate on there, and you can put it on the tank. You know, so there's not a lot of like, oh, we're done with this weapon system. We want to get a new one. The uniform saves obviously a lot of money, and it helps when we start to do operations together. I don't see, if they do adopt the 6.8, I believe it's going to be like the M14. I think they're going to probably make, you know, they'll probably make 2,000 rifles, hand them out as designated marksmen, and on every patrol you'll have a guy with a sniper weapon. You'll have two machine gunners, two saw gunners, an M14 and a 6.8 millimeter. You know what I mean? That's the only thing I can fathom. But to make the statement that a lot of people are making now, that every Marine is going to have a 6.8 millimeter, hey, let's focus on getting every Marine night vision. How about that? How about that for a dream? You know, there's a lot of things that we need to, you know, help the Marines with as far as technology goes. But, you know, you put a 6.8 millimeter in Marine's hands, he's going to ruin your day. And, you know, so... It's not the soldier or the Marine. It's the weapon system. So if you want to put two of those rifles in a platoon, I could see that happening. But I just don't see it as kind of the game changer.
Right. You told me that one of the big problems that our soldiers were having as far as marksmanship was that they weren't used to shooting at targets at a different elevation.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that is, I think, the most difficult thing for an infantryman to do is just, you know, dead reckon distance. We have a lot of great gadgets that can shoot an azimuth and shoot a distance to find out how far away we're shooting, orient your weapon systems to that distance. But a lot of times you're so used to being every Army base, every Marine Corps base, you know, close to 85% of these things are on pretty good straight elevation. A straight terrain, the elevation may differ, but the terrain is always even. And when you get into Iraq, with the exception of northern Iraq, everything else is pretty much big, open, you know, flat area. But when you're sitting at 1,300 feet above sea level, and you're looking up at 8,000 feet, or you're at 8,000 looking down, what might look like 600 meters is really like 2,000. You might find yourself thinking, oh, okay, those guys, I could see them in binos and they're yay big, and you realize, wow, I can't even engage them if I wanted to. So now it's a matter of calling in fire. Now it's a matter of taking these targets out in ways that you're not accustomed to as an infantryman. Yeah, you don't want to call in an artillery strike. You want to shoot these guys. That's the way your brain is trained. And so when you see guys off in the distance, or you see maybe a machine gun nest or something, and you're looking at it, and you're like, you know, I could swear that that's 500 meters. And you start putting rounds on it, and you're like, man, my thing's not even – I'm not even getting impact. I'm not even seeing anything. I can't even get a reference point to how many, you know, picture frames, how many target frames I'm off. That's tough, and I think that's a good chunk of why the far off fighting in Afghanistan is so difficult.
Is that something that needs to be addressed in training? Is that something that needs to be addressed once you're deployed and you're with your unit? What's the solution to that problem?
Well, I mean, that's one of the reasons why our NCOs and our military is the best in the world, is because we adapt to that all the time. It's one of those things, though, that even if, you know, a lot of what we do in the military for young kids coming in is, you know, we use the football field method for distance. And so it's like, you know, every kid, American kid, knows how far a football field is, and they can imagine goalposts and say, okay, that's 100 yards. That's going to be 300 meters. That's going to be 500 meters. That's like five football fields away. I can work with that. But the problem is that if you have no reference point, it doesn't really matter how often you're doing this. If you're not living in that environment for an extended amount of time, it's really tough to do. And so a lot of times when I had situations like that, I would just take one night and go out there and just put some posts up. If I knew I had to do a a static defensive position, I'd go off for a click and put up a giant rod, and I would know that was 900 meters.
Right.
And then, get your little range card and do your thing. But these guys aren't static. They're not, their OPs are one thing, but when they go on patrols, they don't really have that luxury to do that sort of thing. But there's a million different ways that you can go around that, and I'm sure our guys are far more proficient, being out there now than we are talking about it. But it's just something I'm these guys have told me, and the other thing is it's just one of those things. It's like, shooting a machine gun, throwing a grenade. These are things you can hone and master, but you really have to throw a lot of grenades to do it. You know what I mean? And
right,
there's not a lot
right.
of ranges in the world that are going to let you do that. So 9 times out of 10, a really good grenade thrower is a guy who's been in a lot of bad situations. You know what I mean? So it's almost like you don't want that moniker of being the world's greatest grenade chucker,
That's funny that you say it like that. I like the way you put things. Have you ever considered running for office, David?
I think I'm done with that whole thing. Honestly, the job that we're doing right now, which is I got an advocacy group. We've got a charity called the Warrior Legacy Foundation and Vets for Freedom and all this other good stuff. Everything that we're doing for these guys coming home, that to me is far more effective than, let these politicians talk about health care and everything else. Our generation of veterans, we're going to end up running the world. And, we're keeping the world safe right now. We're young. We're going to start filling these seats of power. And I certainly don't have the ego where I need to be the one leading the front. I'm very happy just being home and supporting these guys when they get back too.
Tell us a little bit about the Warrior Legacy Foundation, will you?
Yeah, pretty much you got all these groups out there. One of the things about pro-veteran people, I love them to death. I mean, God bless every single member that's out there. But there's a lot of people who just don't know what the hell to do. They're like, I want to support the troops, but I don't want to get a haircut and go to basic training. I don't really want to give my kid up for the military, which I totally understand. Serving your nation at war is a choice, and it should be taken, mildly. But at the same time, it's like, what the hell do I do? So they put together these care packages and all these wonderful treats, but at the end of the day, there's only so many groups that can do care packages. I mean, there's, hundreds and hundreds of groups that are like, here's some coffee, and, you end up with 85 boxes of baby wipes, and you're still in the same spot that you were in before. They're fantastic, but what we really need in our nation and what the Warrior Legacy Foundation's about is about changing our culture, getting us back to what service is about. Talking about law enforcement, firemen, our young 11 and 12-year-old kids are our demographic. We focus on soccer moms, and we focus on 10-year-old boys and girls. And basically, let them look up to people who serve their country. The reason why we're not like grandpa is because we lost the ideals that serving your country is the most noble thing you can do. And it isn't just with a grenade and a rifle. A police officer is the tip of the spear on the war on terror. Firefighters, teachers, all these things are about service-oriented professions. And when you put it all together, you're empowering what I'm trying to do and what we're trying to do is create a renaissance of the way we look at our nation and the way we look at our community. And if we could take these young kids and say, it's about country, it's about patriotism, and it's about honoring service. That's what our group's about. It's about honoring everyone who's ever served in every uniform from every generation and teaching these, inner city kids that, there's a lot of heroes out there that were in the same spot that you were in. And they educated themselves. They got out of the hood because that they cared about their family and about their community. And the only way we're going to save ourselves isn't from President Obama or Mitt Romney. It's going to be from guys like you and me doing our thing and raising our children to appreciate the freedom that they have. And so that's what we're trying to do.
So if somebody wants to support the Warrior Legacy Foundation, either monetarily or with some time, or what can they do? How do they get hold of it?
Go to warriorlegacyfoundation.org. No crazy spelling there. But we got a great website, and the other thing is we got great relationships with not only other soldier charities, but with every stinking mill blog in the galaxy. So every one of these giant mill bloggers, the 13 million hits that they get, they're all in our camp because we're in their camp. And that's the thing about World Legacy Foundation that I'm so proud of is that there's no ego invested. If you got a good program, we're going to support you. And this whole thing is about the community. It's not about one individual that's rising to the front. And, you know, we try to keep our names out of it. This is not my organization or anyone's organization. It's about what the mission is. And it's a charity. There's no one on, you know, the salaries, there's no staff salary, there's no office, there's no garbage. We're just trying to do the right thing for the right reason. We're a 501c3 tax-exempt organization. And, you know, look at our programs and see what we're doing and, you know, come along and check it out. It's good stuff.
We're almost out of time, but before we go, David, I wanted to talk a little bit about what the main story you had on your blog today, davidbellavia.com. You talked about the war on terror that Russia is fighting now, and we saw these two massive suicide attacks over the weekend, and you spoke that you had a little story in there about maybe Putin has an answer to help save the world from Islamist terror.
Yeah, it's just being Vladimir Putin who wants to, you know, roll around and judo fight every guy that he comes across. I mean, there's a totally the language that you know the government used in Russia right after these bombs went off was very Soviet era. It was, you know, the terrorists are animals. We will destroy them. Any terrorist that threatens our people will die. They're not talking about habeas corpus. They're not talking about any of these things that, you know, the Russian culture is still a communist culture, whether we like it or not. They're very new to the democratic rule, but also, you know, Vladimir isn't really never was a pro-liberty guy anyway. But the way that they're combating this stuff, do you remember the Chinese had the Uyghurs that were the militant Chinese that they they sent off?
They just went in there and just destroyed them.
Exactly, but they did it really quietly, and the guys that survived literally were on record saying, I'd rather be in Guantanamo Bay than back in China. And the reason why we had to put them in Bermuda was because as soon as they got back into China, they were dead. Now, say what you want about, you know, we're better than they are. We're better than they are. If we could get all of these countries, I mean, no one liked Joe Stalin. We all knew that Stalin was a bad, I mean, Patton wanted to kill Stalin. Everyone wanted to kill, everyone knew that the Soviets and Stalin were bad news. But they realized that the greater threat was the Nazi regime at that moment. And there are times that you can really, especially in a global economy that's in the, you know, that's everyone is hurting right now. Now is the time to really kind of circle the wagons. And we need a president who isn't weak. We need a guy that can actually look someone in the eyes. I mean, there was always that moment where Bush and Putin, you never knew when they were going to, like, drop down and oil up and just go at each other. You know what I mean? Like, there was
looking into each other's eyes.
like Putin was the guy who was like, I'm going to, you know, I can snap your head like a walnut with my, you know, my judo power. And then, you know, Bush is a guy who obviously probably just carries a sidearm. And, you know, but there were two testosterone alpha males. And this is the time where you really need to get that. And you have to say, look, you know, we can do something together. And you need, Russia has got to make a decision. Is it about buying cheap oil? Is it about having a partner to buy, you know, missiles from, or do you want to get these guys to buy Iraqi oil? Do you want the Russians in to sell, you know, AK-47s and, you know, inter-range, you know, 2-kilometer missiles to, 200-kilometer missiles to Iraq right now? Get these guys away from Iran, get them back into the world, and start to go after Al-Qaeda and start to neutralize Iran. That's the only future we have. And unfortunately, we've severed those ties, and so now everyone's going to go after terror their own way. The French are going to bake them bread, the Americans are going to bring them into court, and the Russians are going to slit their throat while they sleep. And our kids are still in danger every time they go to a ball game. And it's just a shame, because right now we could really kind of make this a world war, which, by the way, our enemy sees it as a world war. You know, we didn't do anything. The Russians have been killing terrorists for the last 25 years. The war in Afghanistan, by the way, was a war against Islam. It had nothing to do with anything other than to destroy a people, break them down, and you know, Azerbaijan and Georgia and Afghanistan. make them back part of Mother Russia. We've never done that, and yet they still kill us. If anyone, they should be killing the Russians left and right, but they don't mess with them because Putin puts gas in. He killed an entire theater of people to kill like 5 terrorists. This is not a guy you take home to mom.
He does not play. You can tell he's ex-KGB for sure, because he does not play when there's anything threatening anything to do with him. Hey, David, we're out of time. I really appreciate you being on the show. I'd love to have you on again when we get a chance. Is that okay?
It'd be awesome. I really appreciate you and what you're doing, and you got a great program, and I hope people keep tuning in. This is good stuff.
His name is David Bellavia. His book is called House to House. His blog is called davidbellavia.com, everyone. I encourage you to check him out. He's very well-spoken. He has an interesting perspective on everything under the sun. His perspective is very interesting. Thanks again, David.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Coming up next, we have a special Get to Know. One of our longtime members, The Kill, is on Get to Know. Enjoy it, ladies and gentlemen. This week on Get to Know, we have a very special guest. As usual, all ARFCOMers are special to me. This week, his name is The Kill. I know many of you know who he is very well from his many different posts here on ARFCOM. And we've got him live for you today. How are you, The Kill?
Good. How are you doing today?
Doing well today. Doing well. I'm glad we finally worked out a schedule where we could get together on this.
Yeah, I was wondering if we were going to be able to pull it off.
It took us long enough. Anyway, are you ready to dive into these questions?
Yeah, I think so.
All right, let's go. We'll start off with the important ones first, okay?
9mm versus 45?
9 versus 45.
You know, it's kind of a, I don't know, if you want to make that an intellectual exercise, it's okay. You know, I mean, I don't think there's enough hours in the day to worry about arguing about it. If something's worth shooting once, it's worth shooting twice. So if you got a 9mm, just shoot twice. That's the way I look at it. I don't think it really matters.
You've got to pick one.
Personally, I shoot a 45.
45 it is then. There we go. Nothing wrong with that. You're like the big bore. All right, the second huge important question that defines reality on ARFCOM. Beans or no beans?
Is there a right or a wrong answer?
I have not quite figured that out yet.
I haven't either, but seeing as I'm from Wisconsin, it's beans.
Gotta go beans. Yep, Northerners gotta go beans. Okay. Okay, what do you do for a living? I know the answer to this already, I believe.
Well, actually, I do a few things. I work in the transportation industry as a manager. I work for a holding company and travel around the country, mainly handling training issues and regulatory compliance issues involving state-level agencies and federal agencies. And that's my full-time job and career. And on the side, I also play music. I've been a drummer for 20 years, did a couple of tours. And I currently own and operate a small recording studio and record mainly local artists.
Have you noticed, I mean, you probably got more of an inside track on this. You know, everyone talks about the downloading of music illegally and people getting music for free on the internet. Has that significantly impacted the music industry? Are there enough people that still actually pay for music that it's still okay? Or is it now you have to make all your money by touring?
The record labels and the recording industry as a whole, revenues are way, way down because of the impact of file sharing.
Uh-huh.
And it's so easy to do that I don't know that the industry is really ever going to get a grasp on it sufficiently to recover the revenue that they've given up or lost, I should say. You know, so the whole music industry is taking a big hit with it, and it's bad on the side of you know, collecting revenue for your intellectual property. But on the plus side, you know, I mean, there's a lot of artists out there, and it gives a lot more artists a chance to honestly, you know, an honest chance to be heard in a large venue, that being the internet. So
right.
It's down, you know, it's upside and downside. The downside is that when you're on the big level, you know, such that you're represented by a large-scale record label, you know, the old-school way of doing things, you're not going to make nearly as much money as what you once could, especially in, you know, the 80s would probably be the heyday
right.
of the traditional music business model. And nobody's going to make that kind of money, really, you know, anymore. But on the upside, if you're an artist or you've got a band and you're talented, the internet as a venue, it grants you so much more possibility for exposure. And, yeah, your stuff's going to be distributed for free, downloaded, and shared. But considering that you can do it with such low overhead now, you know, a record label collects, if you're on a big record label, you only, if you're lucky, you get 20% of the gross receipts of the sales of your songs. And that's, you know, that's a very small chunk of money if
right.
you're selling records.
So do you see more people going independent now?
Oh, yeah. Independent's the way to go. It's the wave of the future. There's no doubt about that.
So I would say in some ways it's a good thing for the industry because you no longer have these big, huge record labels deciding who's going to be the next hit and who's not. You've got basically the public is going to decide what they like.
Well, they still have that influence in the industry, you know. But there's a whole subculture now in music that's internet-based, and that's just going to do nothing but grow. So, yeah, that is a positive, I would think, for the art side, you know.
Right, right. All right, well, let's move on here. Thanks for the information. I was curious about how that was going to affect the music industry, and it's good to get the info from an insider. If you are sitting down for a nice long Friday night of ARFCOM, what is your drink of choice?
On a Friday, I'm generally drinking a Pepsi.
Oh, okay.
An adult beverage is generally a Jack and Coke or something along those lines.
A Jack and Coke? Okay, we've got two votes now for Jack and Coke as their adult beverage of choice. On ARFCOM, who is your favorite poster, or whose post do you look forward to reading?
You know, I don't know that I necessarily have a favorite poster right now. It seems like the pool of members has gotten so large that there isn't a whole lot of people that necessarily distinguish themselves to me that much. I'd say Subnet's one of them. You know, Subnet generally has quite a few decent posts. He's obviously an adult, you know, and you can...
I love that guy.
The noise level in GD seems to have come up quite a bit, so you got to look a little bit harder to find, you know, posts that are thoughtful. But Subnet would be one of them. I miss Eric the Hun a lot, and I'm sure you probably hear this from a lot of the old schoolers. You know, he was
all the old schoolers talk about Eric the Hun. They all do. I wish I would have been around to know that guy. He seems like he was just such a great guy.
Well, you know, the thing about it was he had such a faith in God, and his sincerity, you know, his sincerity was so obvious. And there are people that seem sincere, and there are people that are truly sincere. Now, the internet, you know, a typed word on an internet forum is a difficult means of communication, but ETH... when you read his post, you knew he was the real deal, and he was just a very, very big man, you know?
Yeah, yeah, he was one of those larger-than-life figures that you run across every now and again, and you feel happy that they were just in your life at all.
Well, and I did get a chance to meet him in person and talk with him at the first Black Rifle Convention that was held in Nebo, Illinois, and he's the same person in real life that you thought he was, reading his posts or chatting with him on the internet.
Right.
And so, you know, I wish Eric the Hun was still around, but let's see.
So we're going to give your vote to Eric the Hun then.
Yeah, let's do that.
How does that sound?
Sounds good, thank you.
Who are some of your least favorite posters or type of posters on ARFCOM?
You know, the one or two word drive-bys that are definitely just really retarded. Which it seems that there's a lot more of that than there used to be. You know, the eject pictures, all that kind of stuff. That stuff kind of gets a little bit old. I don't really pick out names of posters that really irritated me. There was a poster It was like AMS JMS or something like that, and his avatar flag was Chinese, and that guy really got on my nerves. That's one that stuck out, and I had a name for him that I probably can't repeat in an interview.
Okay, we'll keep that one to yourself. We'll keep that to yourself. Yeah, the one-word drive-bys, that's a great term. I love that. Those guys are sometimes annoying, although I am sometimes guilty of that myself, I must admit.
Yeah, well, you know, the staff does a pretty good job of keeping it. It's like the thing with the CTD edits.
Oh, yeah, that was ridiculous. I'm glad they put the kibosh on that.
Yeah, I can totally understand how they would have to come to a decision like that.
Speaking of staff, who is your favorite ARFCOM mod or site staff member?
Ed Senior.
Ed Senior, the man, the myth, the legend. And I'd love to get him on one day for one of these get-to-knows. That's what I'm going to do. My goal is to get Ed Senior on as soon as possible.
Well, you know, Ed Senior is fantastic. Can't say enough about him. I went through a divorce in 2002, 2003 and posted about it on the site, actually. And Ed, I was fortunate enough that he reached out and actually called me. And him and his wife, we talked on the phone on and off for a pretty significant amount of time there when I was going through that. It was a tough time for me. And,
right.
You know, I was really surprised that they took time out to call a member of the site just to talk and offer encouragement and that kind of thing. And, you know, it really impressed me. And,
yeah, that's really cool.
So I have a lot of respect for Ed and, you know, some of the other members, too. The beekeeper, same thing. You know, I spoke with him on the phone. There's a lot of good people on the staff, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's really cool. We've got a really good site staff. The moderators really do a good job, and I can't even imagine how hard it is to do their job here on ARFCOM with all the crap they have to wade through. Now, you've been around since before the changeover, right?
Correct.
When was the first time you got on ARFCOM? Do you remember?
Would have been about 1999 or so, I believe.
Wow, almost the very beginning. If you could live anywhere other than Wisconsin, where would that be?
You know, I've liked just about every place that I've visited when I've left Wisconsin. Texas would definitely be a front runner, as would Kentucky.
Texas or Kentucky? Wow, those are two places that other people have said as well. I have to go to Kentucky, and I've been to Texas once, but I got to get down there because everybody says Texas, and I need to actually go spend some real time there with some real Texans and really see what it's about. And Kentucky, you're the second person that said Kentucky, and that's not an answer I would have expected, but I've never been there, so I don't really know. I've got to go there, too. If you could have any one firearm that's legal for you to own that you do not currently have, what would that be? Anything. Class 3, CNR, anything.
You know, that's a hard question because I've got quite a list. But if it was going to be any weapon out there, I'd say a Select Fire M60.
An M16 with the happy switch. That's a good answer. Good answer. What is your favorite firearm that you own now?
If I had to pick a favorite, I'd probably just pick my 1911.
When was the last time you were shooting? Last time.
Last time I was shooting. 2 weeks ago at an indoor shoot at a range in Waukesha for the Conservative Young Professionals in Milwaukee.
Oh, okay. That's not too long ago. 2 weeks is pretty recent. That's decent.
Yeah, it was actually a gathering, like I said, sponsored by the CYP group in Milwaukee, and I try to be involved in them. I'm involved in a few groups like that, so it was a good time.
Cool. So we already know the answer to this, but you've ever met a fellow ARFCOMer in real life, and what was your impression of them?
By and large, all the ARFCOMers that I've met, we have a lot in common, and that is conservative, a conservative outlook on politics and government, obviously a love of firearms and shooting, self-reliant attitudes, and good people. Pretty much everyone that I've met, with the very rare exception, are people that I'm quite honestly proud to have spent time with and in some cases call them friends.
Have you ever gotten rid of a firearm and regretted it?
Oh, yes.
Let's hear the story.
Well, let's see. 1995, I'd been on tour for a year, and I was broke. I was running out of money. I had my mother and my brother were actually staying with me, and I needed to be able to pay rent. So at the time, I didn't have much of a collection, you know, being a poor, broke musician. But I sold off all the firearms that I had, which was a Remington 870, it was a deer gun,
mm-hmm.
a Chinese SKS. People are going to laugh at this one, but you know, I had a High Point 45 pistol that I sold. yes, the High Point.
Don't ever tell anyone ever, but I actually owned a Lorsen once.
Oh,
yeah. Don't ever tell anyone.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And I also had a, and this is the one that where the regrets really come in, is that I had a Kimber imported Daewoo DR200.
Oh wow. So you had to get rid of all your firearms and start again from scratch?
Yeah, I sold everything except for I kept my .22.
Tell me a little bit about your avatar. Is that you?
Yes, that is. That's me actually wearing the Beekeeper's 50 rifle on the range at the first Black Rifle Convention.
Oh, okay. And when was that first Black Rifle Convention?
I'd have to dig up my shirt to remember what the dates were, but I believe 2000, maybe 2001.
If you were elected President of the United States, what would be the first thing you would do in office?
I think the first thing that I would do, well, I have a list of things that I would do. But
let's hear it.
I think the most effective thing that we could do to move the government and the country in the direction that most of us feel it needs to go in would be to eliminate federal tax withholding from people's paychecks and start making them write a check every quarter.
Really make people mad and want to get rid of the IRS, huh?
Well, it's such a... I understand the concept that's behind doing it, but if you're going to force every citizen of the United States to write a check to the government every 3 months, I think that would go a long way toward getting people to really think about where that money's going and what it's being used for.
Yeah, it definitely would. People would be like, wait a minute, where's this money going? Every week I have to write this check, and what's, you know, to stand behind someone at the store with their free card, and you're just like, oh my goodness, this is where my check went? Anyway, I appreciate you taking some time out to be with us on the show. Keep doing all the good work you do there. I know you're involved in a lot of different political things there in Wisconsin. Keep up the good work. We appreciate it. His name is The Kill, ladies and gentlemen, and he joined us for a Get to Know. Thank you, man.
Thank you.
And we're back on Radio Free ARFCOM. I am your host, John Gold. I hope everybody's following along the hottest thread in months on ARFCOM. I know you guys have seen it, the one about the militia raids. A lot of heated discussion going on over there, and I am going to have somebody on next week's show, an expert on the militias who was on with us last week. Mike Vanderbilt is going to try, we're going to try to get him back on. He has a lot of insight and a lot of connections involved with some of these militias. He'll talk to us about that. Right now, we have Trey Tuggle. He's recently been announced the director for the NRA Tactical Rifle Division. Trey, how are you today?
Good. Doing great.
It's great to hear from you. I know you're a very busy man. You've been on planes all weekend, and you've got maybe 3 hours of sleep, you told me, in the last 2 days. I appreciate you coming on.
I'm glad to be here. I love talking about ARs and three gun, all that good stuff. You know, it's just fun. You know, who doesn't want to talk about that kind of stuff?
Let's just get started with your background. I know you're a former Navy SEAL. Why don't you tell us a little, and we love Navy SEALs here on ARFCOM, trust me, we love Navy SEALs, and I love it that I get to know a couple just from being able to do the show. Now I can say I know two Navy SEALs now after doing this show. Tell me a little bit about how you got, how you enlisted in the Navy, and what your motive was, and what made you enlist, and a little bit about your time in the service. And by the way, let me thank you for your service right off the top. I really appreciate you putting your life on the line for our country.
Sure, no problem. Thanks to the guys, you know, out there today doing it. You know, that's the ones I really want to, I want to thank, you know. They're out there doing it while I'm here with my family, you know. So somebody's always going to carry the torch along. And anyways, thanks to the guys out there. As far as me, you know, I grew up playing in the woods and that kind of stuff down in Louisiana. And, you know, my dad was a hunter safety instructor with NRA since I was about 3 years old. So I grew up in, you know, NRA instruction. Gun safety was paramount, as it always is. But, you know, getting a little older, I started getting into small bore rifle at my high school and learned some fundamentals there. And my dad let me come out and practice with him and his handgun team on the sheriff's department. They were doing PPC competition, and I got to learn how to shoot a pistol a lot better by doing that twice a week. And,
what's PPC competition?
What's that?
What is PPC competition?
It's there's so many acronyms out there, so hopefully I won't mess this up, but I believe it's a police practical PPC, police practical combat or something like
okay.
that. I can't remember. It's the police. They're still doing it today, but they're doing it with auto loaders. Back in the day, you know, when my dad was doing it, they were doing it with the revolvers, and it's a practical style of competition for law enforcement. You know, it's a course of fire that, you know, is supposed to enhance their abilities. So I started shooting that when I was a kid with him. And I had a major in the Green Berets that was my ROTC instructor. He was a pretty cool dude, you know, and I wanted to be a Green Beret for a long time. And, then a buddy of mine gave me a book on Navy SEALs, you know, I was like, oh, you know, that's it, you know? So I think I was about 14 years old when I decided I want to be a Navy SEAL. And, you know, just stuck with it and finally got the opportunity to try out and all that good stuff. And, it was a lot of fun, man. I had a lot of good times.
You told me you actually got to do a lot of work with the mini subs.
Yeah, that was kind of cool. You know, the SEAL teams, you know, we have these little underwater submersibles that we get to drive around and deliver ourselves from place to place with. They're kind of cool, but in another regard, it kind of sucks. I mean, there's no good way of putting it. It really does suck. It's the dirtiest, nastiest, hardest job in the SEAL teams, being in these mini subs.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it's horrible. It's not two ways about it. It's really cool in a lot of ways because I learned to drive them for a little while, and then I discovered that I wasn't great at it. Some guys are really good at it. I wasn't great, but that's okay because I am a really good sniper, or was. I'm too old for that stuff now. So I moved into sniper school, became a passenger in the back, and then I got delivered out of this thing. So, you know, I felt like I was the stealthiest insertion of any special forces guy on the planet, you know. It was a lot
that's
of fun
so
doing that
cool.
kind of stuff.
So these are just little two-man submersible. How many, can you talk about that? How many guys could fit in them, or are you not allowed to talk about that?
Yeah, some of that I can probably go into, but, you know, I mean, there was an article in, I think, Popular Mechanics, you know, 10, 15 years ago on them, you know, and they had a basic picture of them. You know, it carries small crew, you know, more than two, less than 10,
okay,
you know, whatever, somewhere in there, and
I won't press you to break any rules.
Yeah, it's all good. It was a lot of fun, man. I mean, that thing, you know, like I said, I felt like I was the stealthiest insertion in the military, you know? So that was kind of cool, you know?
Yeah, that is really cool. So you took your experience with the SEALs, and you turned it into this Patriot3.com company that you have a piece of?
Yeah, I'm a third owner in this company. Two of my buddies and I got together on this thing years ago, and we built a counterterrorism vehicle. We didn't actually build the vehicle. We built this thing that goes on top of it, and some people call it a siege vehicle, an assault vehicle, whatever. It's a big, weird-looking cheese grater thing that you put on top of a truck. It's kind of very difficult to explain, even harder to explain than the SDV, which is the mini-sub.
If people want to see a picture of it, they can go to www.patriot3.com, and I'm pretty sure Merrill, he's the guy that helps me out on the on the AR15.com website. He puts pictures up in the threads discussing the show. He'll put a picture of this thing up there. It's a really cool looking thing, and it does look like a siege engine for you'd see like to go storm a castle or something.
Yeah, it's a modern day siege vehicle. I mean, it's exactly what it is. But again, you know, I mean, one went from doing the stealthiest insertion in the military to this thing is the fastest, hard hittingest, you know, second, third story balcony window over, you know, perimeter walls, aircraft, you know, insertions. I mean, this thing, you know, it's right now fast, you know. Nothing beats it. So that's a really cool thing. And, you know, I mean, like I said, it's hard to explain that thing, and you really have to go to the website to kind of get a picture of it, you know.
Yeah, I don't know how I would try to describe this to people. It's interesting. It's like you've got an armored vehicle, and on top of it, like you said, there's a cheese grater platform, and then you've got a ramp that goes up, and it can go all the way up to three stories. Is that what you said?
Yeah, you can do some pretty high insertions with it, and you know it's got some other capabilities too. I built a sniper bench for it. You can mount to one ramp, and you can run this ramp up in the air behind concealment, you know, like a tree line or something like that.
Right.
And, you know, the sniper could just poke up over the top of the tree line or, you know, through an open spot and get a good vantage point on what he needs to, still be a bit behind concealment, and he can rotate the shooting platform 360 degrees and engage targets from it.
Oh, wow.
It's neat.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So you go around and you train people on these things and that type of thing, if I understand correctly?
Yeah, I did. I that was part of my job with the three of us as a team, you know. I went out and showed the guys how to use it, and I demonstrated it for potential buyers. You know, so I've been to a lot of the counterterrorism teams around the planet, and that's after I got out of the Navy, you know.
Right.
I've been in the Mideast and through Europe and Asia, you know. I mean, I did a lot of traveling with that company. Had a lot of fun, though. I mean, it's really, really cool getting to go into their compounds, you know, and play with these guys on their tools and their turf, you know.
Yeah, it sounds like just an awesome job, but you're definitely qualified for it. And you're definitely qualified to do this director of the NRA Tactical Rifle. For years and years, the NRA, everybody associated them with hunting and hunting guns only. But in the last few years, it seems like the NRA has made a concerted effort to move to cover all firearms owners and really to focus on guys like us who love the tactical rifles, who love the AR-15 platform, people who are interested in three-gun shooting. We'll get to that in a minute. But tell us a little bit about what this new division of the NRA is.
Well, first off, I mean, I'd like to speak about the Second Amendment. I mean, you know, it's all about protection from enemies, foreign and domestic. I mean, I'm sure you've read it a bunch of times.
Absolutely.
That's what it talks about, you know. And how do you do that? You do that with a black gun, an AR-15, an M14, if that's your weapon of choice, you know. That's what it's about, you know, protecting yourself.
Right.
So
it's not about
all
hunting,
Second
that's
Amendment.
Sure.
So the new division, it's actually underneath High Power. I work for the lady that runs the high power side of the NRA's competition division.
Okay.
And I am tasked with both multi-gun competition and promotion of optics on rifles in shooting matches.
Okay.
You know, throughout the past, you know, there's been a lot more iron sight competition, and nowadays, you know, with the modern day soldier, you know, a lot of those guys are coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and they don't shoot iron sights anymore, you know.
Right.
Everybody's
right.
Got an optic, you know. So when they come back and they want to get off into some style of competition, you know, they're looking at an iron sight going, well, that's great, but, you know, I'm used to an ACOG, you know, or a Leopold, or, you know, aim point, you know. Everybody's got an optic now, so we're looking at building more optic use into our existing competitions, and I'm also looking outwards at what competitions are going on out there with rifles with optics. sniper-style matches and those kind of things.
Right. Now, you told me you went to a three-gun match actually this last week, and it was your first three-gun match you've ever been to, right?
Yeah.
Tell me about that from a first-timer's perspective, because we talk about that on the show quite a bit. I actually had a whole show dedicated to competition shooting, and a lot of it, a lot of the concerns of the few callers we had for that show was, you know, these guys, you watch them on TV, and they're just banging through these courses, and it's like, there's just no way I could do that, and they're intimidated by it. You know, getting just breaking the ice, getting there and breaking the ice for the first time, it's intimidating.
I understand. I mean, you know, here I am, former Navy SEAL, you know, I've done all these counterterrorism things around the planet and all that kind of stuff, and I look at three gun, and I, you know, I'm like, wow, those guys, you know, I can't do that. You know, I don't have their equipment, you know. But, you know, I went there and got the opportunity to hang out with some of them this weekend at Superstition Mountain Mystery Three Gun out in Mesa, Arizona. Mm-hmm. And Dan Furby is the match director. He put on an awesome event. All these guys just really worked hard to get that thing on. But I'm telling you, I mean, it was really amazing to me. Now, I'm not per se new to three gun because, you know, we used to do three gun challenges against each other in the teams, you know?
Right.
So I've shot rifle, pistol, shotgun, one behind the other, you know, against another guy before, you know? But this is a little different, you know? And I'm way out of practice, I gotta tell you, you know. So, you know, I got in there and started talking to some of these guys, you know. Hey, you know, Trey Tuggle, you know. And, oh, man, glad to have you out, you know. Everybody, and I'm talking about from the top competitors down to the other guy that's there his first time shooting it. You know, everybody wants to help you, wants to talk to you, you know. The only advice I have for somebody going out to a three gun to watch it is be cautious of when you think somebody's going to compete. For instance, you know, try not to talk to somebody right before they're going to compete. You know,
right.
After they get done competing, they're going to be jazzed up. You know, beforehand, these guys are prepping.
Right.
They're going over the stage of shooting that they're going to be doing. And they're hit once again and again and again. So go talk to somebody else who's shooting last. You know what I mean?
Right.
And then once that guy you want to talk to gets done, give him a couple of minutes to decompress. You know? But other than that, I mean, everybody just wants to talk and hang out and have fun. And, you know, they'll tell you what kind of techniques they're using and what's good gear and what's not, you know? These guys are the greatest group of people around. I had an absolute blast this weekend. It was great. I learned a lot about three gun.
To me, three gun just, it sounds so like so much fun, and I'm hoping to do my first match this fall. I'm hoping I can get all my equipment put together. I still got a few things I need to get, but hopefully by this fall I'll have all my stuff together. I'll be able to go, and I'll be the first timer. It'll be new for me. So is the NRA, then, are you guys going to sponsor your own three-gun matches? Are you guys going to work within the framework that's already there as far as three-gun matches and just help promote that? What exactly are you guys going to do?
Well, first off, we got to get you in a three-gun match before that, all right?
Okay, let's
Can we agree
then.
On that? Cool, all right.
Yeah.
So secondly, what's been happening in the things that led up to getting me hired, the president of the NRA at the time was John Segler, and he, you know, identified that these new action shooting competitions were up and coming, you know?
Right.
There's a lot of people interested in this stuff. So, you know, he's really smart to identify that. So he put together a special committee on multi-gun competition. And they have met several times now, I believe. And it's not just, you know, some NRA guys hanging out talking about this stuff. You know, and I don't want to downplay, you know, the NRA guys talking about it. But, you know, they have a point of view as well. But they also did something very intelligent, I thought. They invited the industry guys into the committee.
Oh.
So some of the match directors from the biggest matches are on the committee. You know, so they've been able to spend some time talking about it and, you know, what are we going to do and all that kind of stuff. And you know, if they didn't get anything else done, they got me hired to start really plugging at it, you know.
Right.
So, you know, going off what they've talked about and some of the desires and things, you know, we're still got a lot to hash out, and I don't want to really lay out anything because nothing's set in stone yet. But,
right, this is brand new. Like, this literally has just happened in the last couple of months, right?
Right. I don't think the NRA's going to run, you know, a massively big three-gun match ever. Now, you know, we may, who knows, but it takes a lot of effort to put one of these things on. I mean, don't get me wrong, so does Camp Perry, you know?
Right.
You know, that's an immense, big operation, you know? But these three-gun things, you know, I mean, it takes these mass directors, you know, 3-4 months prep time, you know? It takes them weeks and weeks and weeks to build the stages, you know? They've got sponsorship. They've been working for months out, you know? Superstition Mountain, I think they had, you know, something else, if anybody's listening out there. Prizes, baby. You want to win a gun, you know? Get to be a good three-gun shooter. You know, the prize table of the Superstition Mystery was, it was in excess of $150,000, you know?
Holy cow.
Guns, pistols, you know, all kinds of fun stuff. Dylan presses, you know. So
that's what I want.
Yeah, it takes a lot of effort to get one of these three-gun matches on, you know, and it takes a lot of creativity, too. The stage designers, you know, they really spend a lot of time and effort building these things to be cool and new and fun and safe. You know? I can't tell you how many competitors told me safety is just, it's just everything here, you know? And,
right.
You know, you think, okay, somebody's running with an AR-15 and a sidearm, you know, maybe it's a Glock or, you know, a 1911, whatever, in a holster, and they got a shotgun staged down range somewhere, and they're running from position to position, you know, blowing down clay pigeons, you know, with the shotgun, you know, and then they throw that thing in the barrel, and they draw the pistol and engage some steel targets with that, you know, and move on down, get to the, you know, they might put their pistol in a box and then pick up the AR and, you know, engage some cardboard targets with it, maybe a little bit more steel. But these stage designers really went through a lot of effort to make sure that every movement that a competitor is going to make is going to be in a safe manner, you know. There's usually about 3 range officers hovering, trailing, you know, right on these competitors.
Right.
Now, some of the really good competitors can outrun the range officers, you know what I'm saying? it's just the way that is, you know. They get so far out there, you know, but, you know, you don't have to worry about those guys making a mistake. But they're watching, I mean, if they see you move with your finger in the trigger, you're disqualified from the match.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's like that, you know. Safety, safety, safety. The muzzle of the firearm has got to be pointed in a safe direction at all times. If you were to fall down, which doesn't, I asked that question, as a matter of fact, I asked several people, have you ever seen anybody fall down? No, never have. Talked to one guy, he says, yeah, you know, it might happen every blue moon, he says, but people just, you know, if you were to fall down, they're just going to, you know, every effort to keep that gun in a safe direction, finger off
right.
the trigger, first and foremost, safety's on, you know, nobody's downrange. I mean, there's at least 4 range officers per stage. Some of them have 5 or more, you know,
oh,
depending
okay.
on how
yeah.
many people they need to put on it, you know. So safety is really a big issue there. And I was amazed just, you know, not once. I'm telling you, not once. There was over 300 competitors there. Not once did I ever, ever look down the barrel of a gun in the parking lot or on the range. And I can't say the same thing about going to a skeet range. You know, guys break them in half, throw them over their shoulder.
Right.
You know, These guys right. treat muzzle awareness very seriously, you know?
Right. Anyway. And, you know, that's something I had wondered about, too. What happens if you have a negligent discharge or you sweep someone with your muzzle or whatever? They just, you're instantly disqualified.
Disqualified. Done. You know? You're out of
that's cool. Hey, yep. Trey, we're completely out of time. I apologize. I've been running long all show. It's really refreshing right, to see the NRA move in this direction. It's really nice to see this. I can't wait to see some of the things you put together here in the next few months. So we'll get you back on again as soon as you guys get the office, this tactical rifle coordinator office put together, and you start getting some events put together and deciding what direction you're going to go. We'll get you back on and let you tell everybody what's going to happen.
All right. Thanks, John. I appreciate you having me on.
I really appreciate it. His name's Trey Tuggle. He is another American hero. We've got a show this week jam-packed full of American heroes. David Bellavia, Trey Tuggle, and our next guest, ARFCOM's favorite sniper, Nick Randstad. Nick's going to come on. He just participated in a really cool event that commemorates the Bataan Death March, and everybody knows about the Bataan Death March in the Philippines. They captured our soldiers there, and they made... I think there were 72,000 soldiers marched, and only 50-something thousand made it to the end of the march alive. It was just one of those things that, one of those just horrors of war that just you hope it never happens, something like that never happens again. And it was refreshing last year to have someone from the Japanese government actually come and apologize. They had a meeting in Texas, a reunion in Texas for all the survivors from the Bataan Death March, and, a guy from Japan, someone from there, I'm not sure exactly which political office he has in Japan, but he came and apologized. And for the Japanese, that's really big. It's big for them to actually come and apologize to someone. So it was refreshing to see that. We've got Nick on now, our favorite sniper. How are you, Nick?
Hey, I'm doing good. How you doing?
Doing outstanding. I'm sorry I'm running long as you. I always run long on this
show.
No,
that's fine. I've been listening.
Eventually, I'm going to have to just get another hour in here somehow. Tell us about this this memorial march that they do, and I believe it's in New Mexico, correct?
Yeah, and it was the White Sands, and we flew into El Paso on the 19th, and we went out to White Sands and reconned the route out there on the 20th, and they had some survivors out there signing pictures and stuff, and got the honor to meet some of them, and. Then we went back to the hotel, got ready. We had to wake up at like 2 o'clock in the morning.
Oh wow!
And we left about 3 because it was about an hour drive. We got there about 4:15. There was a million cars out there, so it was hard getting through the gate. But we eventually got through, and then we weighed our bags. We had to have 35 pounds. And
you had to have a 35-pound ruck.
The day before we went to the commissary and got a bunch of rice because they had like a food drive at the end, so we just filled our bags full of rice and beans and, you know, dry goods. So at the end we just dumped them into this box for the food drive.
Oh, okay, and, cool. That's cool.
Yeah, we all had a little over 35 pounds. At the end we had about 40-50 pounds because we kept downgrading. it got pretty hot.
Oh, really?
In the morning we got there about 4:15, weighed in, and it was about 19 degrees.
Oh, wow.
So about an hour in, we couldn't feel our toes. They only had so many propane tanks, and there's like 5,700 people out there.
Yeah, I couldn't believe how many people were there. It was amazing.
Yeah, it was a big turnout, because I guess they went from like 100 back in, 89 when they started the thing, I think it was. And now they got, I think it was the biggest turnout they had, 5,700 people. A little over that, and so there's no heaters left. So the ceremony started about 06. They had a general come out and talk, and they honored some guests, and some of the Walter Reed wounded warriors came out from Iraq and Afghanistan, and
right,
the color guard came out. Then they posted the baton flag, and then they did the roll call for the survivors. The survivors got drove out in golf carts, and they stood at attention, and they roll called them. So it was kind
of really
emotional.
Yeah, I bet that was really emotional.
Yeah. Yeah, there's not too many left, actually. You know, they're dying off pretty quick. So
Yeah, that Greatest Generation. There are not too many of them left, and we need to really appreciate the ones that we do
especially
have.
Especially with that event, yeah, you know. It's sad if anybody Google the Bataan Death March, man, they'll read about it, and it's just absolutely horrible.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking.
It's a miracle that
it
people
is.
Lived.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. It's just amazing that the guys actually did live through it, to be honest with you. So
yeah,
when I originally signed
up for it, I didn't really know what I was getting into, and then I Googled it, and I'm like, wow, it was
yeah, it's amazing. There are actually two routes,
reality,
right?
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt you, Nate. There's a short route, and then there's a long route, which is actually the full length of the actual march. Is that right?
Yeah, I believe it was the blue route. I was on the green route. The blue route is like civilians and, you know, anybody who wanted to participate is 15 miles. And we were on the green route, and there's individual events. There was the women's heavy, women's light, men's heavy, men's light. And that was 26.2 miles. And about 12 of it was uphill. It kind of surprised me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
so
like
there's
the
actually women there with full rucks as well, huh?
Say again?
There were women competing with full rucks as well?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We had two women teams. When you get into the events, it's the heavies are five-man teams and five women teams, you know, five lady teams. No more, no less. And you have to have 35 pounds. And there's two checkpoints in the walk or in the march, and you have to be within 20 seconds of each other, kind of like a team thing, you know. And if you're not within 20 seconds of each other, then when you cross this, because they give you this little chip on your boot, and if you're not within 20 seconds when you cross this little sensor, then you're disqualified.
Oh, okay. So everybody has to stay.
Yeah, we had
together.
We had two
group.
Teams for our brigade, and there was one other ladies team. From another brigade, and they were beasts. They almost beat us. Yeah, they're pretty good. They got first place. I don't know where they're from. Yeah, they're pretty good.
Anyways,
we stepped off about 7:40, and it was crazy crowded. It was hard to march through people. It was a little path, and our team did. We started our own pace, and we had two guests on there that really tall guys. So we just let everybody do their own pace. And then we decided, hey, we'll meet every 5 to 6 miles. There's little checkpoints. Every 4 miles, there's a checkpoint with water and oranges and bananas and people screaming and medics and people cheering us on. And so we stopped every couple checkpoints and met up and just started marching again.
Yeah. So you told me there's actually a group of, bagpipers that were there, and they'd play their pipes as they marched through the checkpoints.
Yeah, there's a lot of NATO forces there. I saw some Aussies. I saw the Bundeswehr, the Germans, which we had a beer with afterwards.
Cool, that's right.
They're actually drinking Coors Light of all beers.
Oh, wow, Germans drinking Coors Light. Now that is a picture right there.
Yeah, really. Tastes like piss.
Were they complaining about it?
Yeah, they didn't like it too much. They don't like light beer. There wasn't, you know, not much of a selection out there, so they'll drink whatever. But the Bundeswehr was out there, the Aussies, I saw some French. Actually, during the ceremony, after the ceremony was done and the march, right before the march began, the Raptors came flying through. We had two jets come through.
Oh, wow,
the Raptors.
Really?
Yeah, they did a flyover, and it was pretty cool.
Yeah,
I actually got I actually got all the pictures today, and I'm going to post them up on the site pretty soon so everybody can get a look at the survivors and the flag and the ceremony.
Yeah.
And the bagpipers and the Scots were there. The bagpipers led the march, and each checkpoint they'd start playing the bagpipes. It was kind of cool.
Yeah, that is cool. I was looking at some of these finishing times, and some of these people had to have run for the entire 26 miles to get these times.
Yeah, some of the teams, they get to, all they do is practice for this march.
Oh, okay.
I think the team that won it was the ODA team, because I saw them running in the beginning.
Oh, you did?
And all they did is ruck anyway.
What was their time, something like 4 hours, or was it less than that even?
Yeah, no, it was like four hours and 17 minutes, so they were doing like 6 miles every hour. which is like ungodly. Like, we were doing 4 miles every hour. Yeah.
How hard was it for you?
No, I was good. It wasn't hard for me. It was challenging going up to maybe mile 8, because it was nothing but straight up for 12 miles, and mile 8 kind of got me. But after that, I was good, because I haven't climbed the mountain for, you know, about a year or so.
Right, since you've been in Afghanistan.
Yeah, but I handled it good. One of our guys that got hey-you'd because one of our guys dropped out, and we had to pick up a guy that didn't train with us. He's kind of sucking.
Oh, he wasn't ready for it, huh?
No, he wasn't, but he did good. He finished with us, and we all finished together.
Right on. I don't know if I could go 26 miles with 35 pounds on my back. I don't know if I could do that. That's
yeah, you
just
could
amazing.
Oh, another thing. I'll be your partner in that three shoot.
Oh, the three gun?
Yeah, the three gun. Yeah.
Oh, okay. We'll have to put something together then. You'll have to carry us then, because I'm not going to be very good. I promise you. Yeah,
I'll show you a thing or two.
Together.
We'll win. Ain't no one going to beat us.
Okay, right on. I'd love to hear that. Yeah, we'll definitely talk to you. We will put something together. Yeah, we'll put an event together here sometime this year, and we'll get together on that. That sounds like a whole lot of fun. Your dad told me to ask you. We're running out of time. He told me don't let you.
Oh yeah, real quick.
Without asking you about this story that happened in Afghanistan, something about something you got with an IED.
Little military humor.
Yeah.
Yeah, 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 real quick, I'll make it real quick. Yeah, we got some intel about a mine in a small village in the NRAO from one of the local nationals. And we had a unit coming up from the south anyway, so we picked a mission. And we got out, and what were we, I don't want to give the town out. But,
sure.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. And we got out to the town, and we got with the local national, and we explained to the turp, hey, here's this VS-17 panel, you know, the orange-pink panel. They're like, here, give this to the local national, and because the local national gave us intel that there was a mine out there on the road.
Okay.
So we gave him the VS-17 panel, and he took the VS-17 panel, went around the corner, and we told him just to place it on there for the EOD, you know, just mark the target.
Right.
And it took a little while. So me and the commander went into the police chief's office, you know, talked to him, see how things were going in the village. We come back out and we see him walking towards us with the VS-17 panel. I was like, sir, I think that local national has something in his hand. He's carrying the VS-17 panel in his hand. And so we yell to our turf, hey, tell him to stop and put whatever's in his hands down. Apparently, at the end of it, I guess he thought it was some kind of protective cloth or something, because he had dug the mine up and stuck and wrapped it in the VS-17 panel and was walking it to us.
Like, oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
And POD got back with us later on that day and said, yeah, this is a live pressure mine. You know, like it was a Russian mine.
How did it not go off? How did he dig it up?
He dug it up out of the ground, and it was exposed from the top, you know. And he dug it up and wrapped it up, and he told our turf, like, oh, I thought this was some kind of protective cloth you were giving us, because, you know, they don't know.
Wow.
So we give it to COD, and they put it in this little valley right over there, you know, right where we were. And they were going to do a controlled debt. And then we saw a bunch of cows walking through, and I was like, I talked to my buddy, he was driving, and I was like, hey, there's a bunch of cows over there. And then all of a sudden, boom, I mean, they did the controlled debt, huge explosion. I was like, is that a cow rolling down the hill?
Oh, no.
And it didn't explode. That cow actually got up and walked off. I was like, they make them tough in Afghanistan. You know?
The cow didn't die from the mine explosion? That is crazy.
No, it didn't die. It just got up and moved out. Took a knee and drank some water and moved out.
That's a great story right there. That is funny. Your dad, got this list of stories. He's like, Nick has just got all these stories, so we're going to get you on again and give us some more stories. But real quick, we've only got a couple minutes, Nick. Tell us a little bit about how the militia is doing these days.
Yeah, we're doing good. I think we're currently, we got, I want to say four or five units we're supporting right now. And now, I just been informed that, we got requests from individuals, saying, hey, we need such and such. So we're starting to do individual requests of whatever anybody needs. So if anybody needs to shoot them up, if anybody needs to find out where we are, just, you know, go on AR-15, search Reinstead's Militia or RepMac, you'll find our thread. And, you know, it's cheap to fill up a box and send it to the guys downrange and whatever they need.
It is. It doesn't cost much money at all. If you want to put together something yourself, you can do it. If you want to just donate a little money, they've got a PayPal account you can send some money to, and they make sure all the money goes into those boxes and sent for soldiers on the front lines.
Yeah, they love Copenhagen Skull, you know, the tobacco stuff. We've sent thousands of dollars worth of stuff down, guys downrange, and it's nothing. Coming from me, it's nothing but a morale booster, because I used to get stuff from the militia, and I used to dish it out to my guys, and it puts a smile on their face and helps us with the mission, you know. It keeps their mind off the bad stuff, you know, and depression, and puts a smile on their face, helps them complete the mission.
It's a really cool homegrown little ARFCOM thing, and
it's a little tiny little thing we've got going.
Yeah, it's getting so big now. It's really neat. So everybody, please do a search, do a quick search for Randstad Militia or RetMac, any thread authored by RetMac, and you'll find it on there. Hopefully, with you being on the show tonight, the thread will get bumped back up to the top in general discussion. And just go check it out, see what they're all about, see if it's something that you're willing to.
And big ups AR15.com. You guys made it happen.
Absolutely. Thank the Avilas for everything. Thank them for the show, for the website, for the militia. It just a great family to be able to be associated with. It's a real honor. And it's an honor to have you on. I really appreciate you coming on, Nick, at such short notice.
Yeah.
And we're going to get you on again really soon. I got to hear some of these stories that your dad talks about. And he's proud of you, and he has every right to be. I want to thank you again for your service, man. I really do. You're a real American hero.
Yeah,
I know you don't feel that way, but you are.
Thank you, man.
All right.
Hey, hit me up if you want to be in that competition.
I will. I'm gonna work it out, and we'll figure out where we can both make it to one, and we'll go do it for sure. I'm excited now. I'm gonna go get my rest of my stuff together so I can do it. His name is Nick Randstad. He is ARFCOM's favorite sniper, and now I can officially say I know a sniper. Everybody else says they know a sniper, but I know a really good sniper. His name is Nick Randstad. This was our show of American heroes. We had nothing but American heroes on today, from Joe DeBurgolis. David Bellavia was on, a real American hero. Trey Tuggle, another American hero. Nick Randstad, another American hero. Just a great show today. I hope everyone enjoyed it. If you missed part of it, come check out the podcast at radiofreearfcom.wordpress.com. I want to thank Merrill, as usual, for keeping all the threads up to date with the pictures and the links for all the guests and some of the things we talked about. I thank all my listeners for supporting the show. You guys are a great bunch of guys. I've got a hardcore group of serious listeners that tune in every week. Thank you to all my guests, to Seth, the super producer, for making it happen and letting us run long tonight. I appreciate it, Seth. I'll see everybody next week right here on Radio Free ARFCOM. God bless America.
The chair is against the wall. The chair is against the wall. John has a long mustache. John has a long mustache.